This teaching is a continuation of last week's teaching, and so if you weren't here last week or did not get to listen to it, I strongly suggest that you get one of the CDs or listen online, because we talked about the two problems of sin last week, and as Israel was in Egypt, they had two major problems. One, of course, was slavery, and God provided a solution to their slavery. And the other was, God's going to pass through the streets of Egypt, and he is going to slay every firstborn of man and beast, without exception. But there's one way to be delivered of this. And the solution, of course, was the lamb. The blood of the lamb, when applied to the doors, the outside doors, to the doorposts, the lintels of the homes, God says, I see the blood, I leap over you. No death will come into your home. So they were passed from death to life by the blood of the Lamb. And of course, this is a picture of who? This is a picture of our Messiah, Yeshua, who was slain on the day of Passover. Because every year we commemorate this day of liberation from Egypt. And it was on that day of Passover that our Lamb of God, who takes away the sins of the world, was crucified. And his blood passes us from death to life. But how about the slavery? The next morning, did they just wake up in Egypt still slaves? No. Not only could they leave Egypt, they were driven out of Egypt. And they had a long walk ahead. They needed strength to put distance between themselves and Egypt. Where'd that strength come from? The body of the lamb. Because they fed on that body of that lamb. They roasted that body. They ate all of it. And then they had strength to walk. And this is something we need to do over and over and over again. And last week I shared that never again in history ever has Israel had to put blood on the doors of their homes. That was a one-time thing. But every year since then, they fed on the body of a lamb. They would kill a lamb and take its body in their home, roast it and eat it. And even today as we commemorate Passover, we do not put blood on the doorposts of our homes. But boy, we do have a feast, that's for sure. The body of the Lamb is the Word of God. It's his very body. It's the essence of who he is. And as we take this, as I was praying, we take this Word from God. We bring it to our hearts and minds and souls, and it gives us strength. It informs us how to live in this world. And we need to take what comes in through our ears and live it out through our lives. Now, the body brought freedom. The blood brought life. And what I want us to do as we go through this Torah portion, we're going to skip some of the things that we usually focus on, like the parting of the Red Sea. I mean, that's really cool. And the song of the sea and all of that. We've analyzed that and studied it before. And you can never get done studying it. But I want to look at something that we've never quite looked at before and teach something I've never gone over with you before. And that's spiritual food. Because you'll notice in this Torah portion, food and drink is a constant theme. Food and drink all the way through. And as you go through, every time new food or new drink is introduced, it's somehow superior to the previous. It's always superior. And it becomes less physical and more spiritual. It's an amazing thing to watch. It's an amazing transition. Now, when they made the Passover sacrifice, when they cooked the lamb, they made unleavened bread. They made unleavened bread. And we find this passage where they do the unleavened bread in chapter 13. So let's pick it up there, chapter 13, verse 3. This is actually part of last week's portions. We're backing up just a bit. So they're getting ready to make the Passover meal, and it says in verse 3, Moses said to the people, remember this day on which you departed from Egypt, from the house of bondage, for with a strong hand God removed you from here. And therefore, chametz, which is leaven, may not be eaten. Today you are leaving in the month of springtime, and it shall come to pass when Adonai shall bring you to the land of the Canaanite, Hittite, Amorite, the Hivite, the Jebusite, which he swore to your forefathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey. There's food mentioned again. You shall perform this service in this month. So in other words, for the rest of your days, all your generations, to the end of time, every year, at this time of the year, on the 14th of Nisan, you remove all the leaven from your homes. And then he says, for 7 days, it says, a land verse 6, for a 7 day period, you shall eat matzot, which is unleavened bread. And on the seventh day, there will be a festival to Adonai. Now, is there anything special about matzah, unleavened bread? Not too much. They physically just made the bread like they normally do, but as you read the account, they did not have time to let it rise. There wasn't time. They made the dough and kaboom. The Egyptians said, get out of here. And so they took the dough, didn't have time to let it rise, they just quickly kind of fried it or baked it or whatever, and they stuck it in their backpacks and off they went. And so they ate unleavened bread. But with the unleavened bread came a commandment. And this is what I want you to notice. This unleavened bread was entirely physical. The only thing about it, it didn't have leaven in it. That's why it's called unleavened bread, matzah. But with this new food, there came a commandment. And that is, every single year at this time, you get all the leaven out of your homes. And this is always a fun thing for us. I know we all go through our cabinets, we're looking at all the labels and everything. Oh, it's got yeast in it. It's amazing how much stuff has yeast in it. Oh, that's got to go. That's got to go. So, I mean, we're just pigging out on anything that's got yeast on it that week leading up, so it's out of the house, you know. And it's a good time of house cleaning, to getting everything out of the oven and the closets and the cupboards and just making sure there's no yeast in the house. We make a game of it with our kids. And then for 7 days, we eat nothing with yeast in it. And you know, this 7 day period is not really about yeast. The 7th day period is about learning to examine our lives, asking, where is there spiritual leaven in my life? Leaven is always a picture of sin and pride. Sin and pride. Yeshua told his disciples, beware the leaven of the Pharisees. Sin and pride. And for 7 days, God almost lets us make a game of it. And as we're looking in so carefully what we put in our bodies, it makes us aware of, what's the leaven that I just allow to arise in my life? Leaven just comes up on its own. And so with this new food, he brings a commandment. It's a very simple one. It's a very physical one. Every year, get the leaven out of your houses and don't eat unleavened, or don't eat anything with leaven in it for a 7 day period. You start with Passover, go 7 days, and after that, you can have leaven again. But then as they go along, they come up to a place in chapter 15. This is after they pass through the Red Sea. In chapter 15, they come to a place, they're thirsty, and there's water, but the water is undrinkable. Because the water is bitter, it's mara. And it says in chapter 15, verse 23, they came to Mara. Now, Moses' sister is Miriam. Yeshua's mother was named Miriam, or we pronounce it Mary or Miriam. But it all comes from this word Mara, which means bitter. They came to Mara, but they could not drink the waters of Mara because they were bitter. And of course, in the Passover meal, we eat maror, which is bitter herbs. So I'm just giving you some of the linguistic stuff. It's free. It's nothing extra. I charge you for that. Therefore, they named it Mara. The people whined. That's the word I like to use. It says complained here, but they were whining. The people complained against Moses, saying, what shall we drink? He cried out to Adonai. And Adonai showed him a tree. He threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. Now, this is not a recommended method for purifying bitter water. Who would ever think, there's a bitter water here, oh, there's a tree. God says, yeah, throw the tree in. That's not how you purify water. In fact, according to Jewish tradition, not only was the water bitter, but the tree was very bitter as well. But when you threw the bitter tree into the bitter water, the water becomes sweet. What is this tree a picture of? It's a big, somebody's obedience. What's the tree a picture of? It's a picture of the cross. In fact, in the Hebrew, The Hebrew is an amazing picture here because it's actually pictured there. The teaching of this tree. Let me show you something. Now, which letter of the Hebrew alphabet means across? Which letter? Tav. Yes. So let's make the letter Tav. The letter Tav. The last letter of the Hebrew alphabet, Tav, looks like this. And last week we looked at how when they put the blood on the lintels of the doorpost of the door, it actually formed the letter Tav. Okay? That's the letter, and in Hebrew, that word Tav means across. You look in a Hebrew book about the alphabet where it gives you the meaning of each of the letters' names, this is a cross. Right? The last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. You say that doesn't look like a cross. Well, actually, when Yeshua was crucified, it's highly unlikely he was crucified on a T-shaped structure. You know, when Romans crucified people, they weren't too particular about the feng shui and the shape of what they were nailing their victim to. A wall, a tree, they didn't care. But when there's a place of public execution that was used over and over for crucifixions, they wanted to make it easy on themselves. They didn't want to dig a hole every time, make a cross, lift it up. They made it easy on themselves. They had vertical posts placed in the ground every 4 or 5 feet or so. And they left them there. The posts just stayed there. The cross beam is what Yeshua carried through the streets. And then what they did when they nailed his hands to the cross beam, they lifted the cross beam up and they hung it on the vertical post. And he was crucified spread eagle like this. Okay? So the pictures we normally see are not very accurate. And so this way it made it easy on the Roman soldiers, the executioners. But what they did not realize is they were actually forming a letter Tav, which means cross. And when the Israelites put the blood on the lintels and doorposts, they were forming a Tav, which means cross. Now, he was hung on the tree, so we'll let that Tav represent a tree. Now, one of the words for rotten or bitter or stinky is the word, let me make sure I spell it right, it's spelled a mem kof. Mem kof. Mach. It's used a couple times in Scripture. It's used in Isaiah 3:24. In Isaiah 3:24, it says, instead of perfume, there will be rottenness. Okay? Something stinky. It's used again in Isaiah 5:24. Therefore, as the tongue of the fire devours the stubble, and as dry grass sinks down the flame, so their root will be putrid. Phew. Now, guess what happens if you place a Tav in the middle of the word for rottenness and putrid? You get the word matok. Mem, Tav, Kof. That is the word used here in Exodus for sweet. Okay? Matok. It's the word that's used there in verse 25, I believe it is. Let me put my glasses on. Verse 25, he cried out to Adonai. Adonai showed him a tree, he threw it into the water, and the water became matok. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that amazing? God's language, this language of transcendence, is phenomenal. And like the rabbis say, and I've shared this same with you before, they say trying to study God's word by means of a translation is like kissing a woman through a veil. In other words, it's better than nothing. But if you can take the veil out of the way, get the translation out of the way, direct contact with the Hebrew, that's where the action is, so to speak. Okay. So I was telling Robin, I said, you know, I'm so frustrated with this Torah portion because probably more than any Torah portion that I'm aware of, this one is so jam-packed with spiritual imagery. I'm honest. Honestly, there may be another one, but for me, this Torah portion of B'Shelach, it seems like every word, every sentence, every statement is packed, just jammed full of spiritual imagery. And we could talk from now until sundown and on to morning, and we still would not make a dent in this Torah portion. So I'm just picking one thread here to follow. Yes? It's what?
Jesus.
You mean Passover?
Well,
Passover.
Passover, yeah. Jewish
yeah.
Because
right. Yes, but that's Passover, not communion. So we can't get those confused. Communion's okay, but what Yeshua's talking about is Passover. Yeah. All right, let's move on. Let's move on. So, bitter water. He turns the bitter water sweet by throwing this tree in, but again, like with the matzah, he gives a commandment. Look what he says. Go to the next verse, or let's finish verse 25. He cried out to Adonai. Adonai showed him a tree, threw it into the water, and the water became matok. It became sweet. There he established for the nation a decree and an ordinance, and there he tested it. Now, I want you to notice, every time that there's new food, new drink introduced to Israel, it's accompanied by a commandment, by a decree, by instruction. God's teaching us a powerful lesson here. And look what he says. Verse 26, he said, if you hearken diligently to the voice of Adonai your God, and do what is just in his eyes, give ear to his commandments, and observe all his decrees, then any of these diseases that I placed upon Egypt I will not bring upon you. What does this have to do with a tree? What does it have to do with bitter waters being made sweet? It's this. He's saying, listen, I know it's totally illogical to make bitter water sweet by throwing a tree into it. But if you listen to my voice, which may not make logic to you, if you follow my decrees, which at times will make no common sense to you whatsoever, and you keep my commandments, even though you can't figure out what logical sense they make, I'll be making your bitter water sweet. And the consequences of Egypt, who lived according to its ways and its logic and its way of seeing things, you won't experience that. You're going to experience sweetness because you're doing things according to my supernatural ways, according to my instructions, and not according to the logic of Egypt, the logic of this world. You see? Which is the greater miracle, unleavened bread or turning bitter water sweet? A lot of unleavened bread really isn't a miracle. It's completely natural. But turning bitter water sweet by throwing a bitter tree into it, that's pretty miraculous. Well, God didn't create water here. He takes water that's already there and makes it drinkable. But then as they go on, they run out of food. The matzah eventually runs out and it is gone. And so we come to chapter 16. Verse 3. It says, the children of Israel said to them, if only we had died by the hand of Adonai in the land of Egypt, as we sat by the pot of meat. Now, I've never pictured telling Robin, you know, when I die, I want to die by a pot of meat. You know, and just... you know, and a bag of potato chips. Now you're talking. Yeah. When we ate bread to satiety, oh, we were so full. We could just die fat and happy. For you have taken us out to this wilderness to kill this entire congregation by famine. Well, they had it all figured out, didn't they? If we just died by the hand of God, by the pot of meat, instead of you taking us out here to die by famine. You know, it's like, these people ever learn, and then I realize it's me. I look back at the things God has done to sustain me, the works he's done in my life. I look back and his hand is so clear what I've done. But right now it's like, Lord, are you even around? And he's like saying, haven't you learned anything? You never see my hand working. You only see where it has worked. When Moses later asked God, I want to see your glory. God says, well, you can watch my back. I'll let you see my back. In other words, you can see where I have been, but you cannot see where I'm at or where I'm going. You can only look at my history. You can't look at my face. But through Yeshua, we're commanded to seek his face. There's a new opening for us to seek his face. But it's hard work. It takes lots of time. It takes lots of devotion. So, let's pick it up in, we'll go another couple of verses. Verse 4, Adonai said to Moses, Behold, I shall rain down for you lechem min shemayim, bread from where? From heaven. Now this is interesting. Bread normally comes up out of the earth, doesn't it? We even do a blessing over the bread. We'll do it later, where we say, Hamotzi lechem min ha'aretz, who brings forth bread from the earth. And God's going to bring it out of heaven? It's like, that does not make sense. But he's going to rain down bread from heaven. Now what's really strange is we're used to seeing rain come out of heaven. That's where our source of water is. But God says, no, I'm going to bring that out of a rock. You see, we're living in it. He's bringing Israel to a place where all their logic and their way of experiencing the world is turned completely on its head. I will rain down bread from heaven. Let the people go out and pick each day's portion on its day, so that I can test them whether they will follow my Torah or not. Isn't that interesting? Bread and Torah, manna and Torah, are inextricably linked together. If you watch this passage, their physical nourishment through manna, their spiritual nourishment in Torah, cannot be separated. It says in verse 5, It shall be that on the sixth day when they prepare what they bring, it will be double what they pick every day. And then he gives them some instructions. I wish we had time to go through verse by verse by verse. But let's go on down and pick it up at verse 22. It happened on the sixth day that they gathered a double portion of food, 2 omers for each. And all the princes of the assembly came and told Moses. He said to them, This is what Adonai has spoken. Tomorrow is a Shabbat, a rest day, a holy Sabbath to Adonai. Bake what you wish to bake, cook what you wish to cook. And whatever is left over, put away for yourselves as a safekeeping until the morning. They put it away until morning as Moses had commanded. It did not stink and there was no infestation or no worms in it. You see, the part we skipped over talks about how if people went out and gathered more than they could eat in one day and they left it over till morning, what happened? It began to stink. It was filled with worms. Now, that doesn't normally happen with regular food. If you leave it sit for 3 or 4 or 5 days, yeah. But overnight, no. But with God's food, it's good for that day. Okay? But the next day it's stale. Not just stale, it smells bad. It's filled with worms. I'll go ahead and take some time and go over this. You know, how is it that spiritual food can do this? You think spiritual food would be eternal food. Well, see, manna is attached to obedience. It's more supernatural than unleavened bread, which isn't supernatural at all. It's more supernatural than bitter water being made sweet. This now has become even more supernatural. The only physical thing they have to do is go out and gather it each morning. Gather a double portion on Friday. Don't leave it over till the morning. Unless it's Friday, then you have enough for Shabbat. That's all they have to do. If they disobeyed during the week and left some over, it became rotten and wormy. If they didn't get a double portion on Friday, the next day there was none to be had. But the double portion did not become rotten and wormy. And then a few verses later, he says, I want you to get a jar of manna. I want you to put it in the ark that you're going to be building later. And it's going to stay fresh in that ark for the next several centuries. So, does manna become rotten overnight or not become rotten overnight, or does it last forever? The answer is yes. It depends, are you obeying God in regard to the manna? You see? The manna, the spiritual food, is directly tied to your obedience. It's directly tied to the Shabbat. Let's go a little bit further. We'll pick it up in verse 25, 16:25. Moses said, Eat it today, for today is a Sabbath for Adonai. Today shall not find it in the field. 6 days shall you gather it, but the seventh day is a Sabbath. On it there will be none. It happened on the seventh day that some of the people went out to gather, but they did not find. Adonai said to Moses, How long will you refuse to observe my mitzvot, my commandments, and my Torah, my teachings? See that Adonai has given you the Sabbath. That is why he gives you on the sixth day a two-day portion of bread. Let every man remain in his place. Let no one leave his place on the seventh day. The people rested on the seventh day. And then it goes on to describe the manna. The unleavened bread is attached to the commandment of every year eating unleavened bread for a week. It's a very physical commandment, but it has spiritual connotations. The bitter water being made sweet is attached to the commandment, listen to my voice, obey my commandments, my statutes, my decrees. Because they won't make sense to you any more than a bitter tree being thrown into bitter water and the water becoming makot, becoming sweet. But now he's giving something more supernatural than bitter water being made sweet. He's giving him bread that rains down from heaven every morning, 6 days a week. And then the commandment about the Sabbath. As the food becomes more spiritual, the commandments become more specific. They become more internal. They become more immediate. You know the Sabbath. I want to talk about the Sabbath a little bit, but please, if you're not a Sabbath keeper, relax. I'm not condemning anything this morning. My job is not to condemn you. My job is to inspire you and encourage you. I want to share a little story. I've shared it with a few of you, but I had the strangest thing happen to me last summer. There's a certain office supply place I go to regularly to pick up, you know, paper and paper clips and folders and, you know, stickers and labels and things we need for the congregation. So we have an account there and I have a card. And so last summer, I forget when it was, July or early August, I went, pick up a bunch of stuff, take it to the checkout. And there's a guy there. I won't give his real name. We'll just call him Ned. And as Ned begins to ring up things, I said, now this is all tax exempt. Okay? And I've got a little card there to show it's tax exempt. So without a smile, he says, well, is this for a school or for a church? And I thought, well, none of your business, but I just said it's a church. More of a synagogue, but church, it's a church. So he's ringing up. Whatever, and what kind of church? What's it called? I said, it's Beth Tikkun Messianic Fellowship. What does that mean? Never heard of it. He's ringing me up. I mean, I want to buy paper clips. I'm being rung up by the Grand Inquisitor here, you know. And I said, well, we're a Christian Jewish group, you know, and we love Jesus as our Messiah. We also keep the Torah. I thought, okay, now he'll shut up, you know, leave me alone. Oh, you're like Seventh-day Adventist then, huh? I mean, seriously, I mean, this is the conversation. I says, no, we're not Seventh-day Adventist, but we do keep the Sabbath. We're not under the law, we're under grace. And right then I felt grace completely slipping away from my attitude. I mean, I was ready to go across the counter. I just got angry. I thought, what business is this of yours? And, I mean, is this what you do to everybody that comes through here? And I was esteemed. I don't get angry too often. Most of you know I don't get angry. I'm pretty kind of even-keeled. But I was just fuming. I went out home and I told Rob about this and made her mad. She got mad at this guy too. I'm thinking, God, what was that all about? You know, what was that all about? Well, about 2 weeks later, Robin and I are home. We're down in the basement. I think we're watching a show or something. I hear the doorbell ring. So I go upstairs. There are two guys been going through the neighborhood passing out tracts for their ultra-conservative church. There's a Baptist church, ultra-conservative. I mean, King James 1611, those guys. They're ringing my doorbell. I open it, and guess who's on my doorstep? It's Ned and his sidekick, who I'd never met. And they're there, and he recognized me. And I recognized him. I said, come on in. You know? And of course, their first job is to find out, am I saved? And I had to jump through the hoops, so I think they thought, okay, he's saved. But we started talking, and I said, come on into my office. And we start talking about Torah. We start talking about this and that. I even gave them each a copy of my book. And I mean, oh, I could just see Ned squirming. And I thought, okay, Now you're on my turf, you know. But we had a very pleasant, at least it's pleasant from my side of things, but we had a pleasant conversation. But he brought up this thing about, I mentioned something about the Sabbath, and he says, but you know, out of all the Ten Commandments, the Sabbath is the only one that's not reiterated in the New Testament. Well, I was ready for that one, because you see, I used to teach that same thing. But the truth of the matter is, of all the Ten Commandments, the one that stands out the most in Yeshua's speech is the Sabbath. Let's turn to it. It's in Matthew chapter 12. It's in Matthew chapter 12. At the end of the story, ever since then, when I go back to the office supply store, I don't get grilled anymore. Okay, but I mean, what are the chances? What are the chances? I mean, this store is nowhere close to my house. It's nowhere close to his church. And yet, there they were. But if you go to Matthew chapter 12, let's read the first 8 verses. At that time, Yeshua went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. Now, in the Torah, it says that if you're walking through someone's field. Now, Yeshua didn't own fields. The disciples didn't own fields. So it sounds like they're stealing. To us, it sounds like, oh, they're going through somebody's field and eating his crop. That sounds like stealing. But in the Torah, it says when people pass through your field, they're allowed to take grapes or grain and eat it. They're not allowed to get their sickle out and start cutting it down and harvesting it. But they can take what they can hold in their hand and eat. But they're not allowed to take things home to save for later. So in other words, God's telling the people, your fields aren't really your own. They're mine. I'm the one who gives the crops. So if people walk through your fields and they're hungry, let them eat what they can eat with their hands and go on. But they're not allowed to carry, or that would be stealing. So they're going through this field, and they're not violating any commandments. And they're hungry. It says the disciples were hungry, and they began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. But when the Pharisees saw it, they're always shadowing Yeshua to catch him doing something wrong. They said to him, look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath. Now, it doesn't say Yeshua was eating. He says your disciples. Have you not read? Yeshua, verse 3 said to them, have you not read what David did when he was hungry? And those who were with him? How he entered the house of God, the tabernacle that stood at that time. And he ate the bread of presence, the showbread, which it was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with them, but only for the priest. Verse 5. Or have you not read in the Torah how on the Sabbath the priest in the temple profane the Sabbath and are guiltless? In other words, on every Shabbat, the priests go into the temple. And there's still a morning and an evening sacrifice they do. They trim the wicks on the menorah and light the menorah. And according to Jewish tradition, you don't kindle fires on the Shabbat. And there's a number of things, of activities they perform in the temple on the Sabbath. And yet the Torah says they can do that. And then he says in verse 6, I tell you something greater than the temple is here. And if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Now, only we Gentiles who start at the end of the Bible and kind of back our way through it could ever come to the conclusion that Yeshua is saying here, I'm Lord of the Sabbath, so it's done away with. I've just canceled it. You have to start at the front of the Bible and go forward through it to realize what he's saying. What he is saying here, and we could add a lot other commandments. The commandment like if it's on the Sabbath and your neighbor's ox or his donkey's in the ditch, you get down the ditch and help him get it out on the Sabbath day. He could have gone to the commandment that if you're a farmer and you own farm animals, on the Sabbath, though you're not allowed to work those animals, you go in there and you feed them. And then Yeshua, of course, he healed on the Sabbath. What's he saying here? He's saying the Sabbath is for life. And it's to issue forth life. David and his men were starving. They come to the tabernacle and there's 12 large loaves of bread. That bread is for life. And so he ate the bread. the priest gave it to them. He never thought twice, oh, this is just for the priest. You can't eat it. He didn't do that. He fed them because it's for life, you see. And the priest in the temple, why are they serving there? It's for life. It's for light. Why does Yeshua heal on the Sabbath? Because life is going forth. Why could they didn't have their sickles out there harvesting the crops. They're just getting some grains. They're hungry. It's for life. Everything about the Sabbath is for nourishing and giving strength for life. That's why manna is attached to the giving of the commandment of Shabbat. God doesn't wait till they're at Sinai to give them a commandment of the Sabbath. He does it right there when he starts raining down bread from heaven. In fact, the sages have a saying that only those who eat the manna. Well, let me get it right instead of me misquoting it. It says, the Torah was given solely to those who eat manna. Because you see, resting in God and feeding upon the beauty and the nourishment, the life that comes from resting that seventh day of the week, it's manna. You know, too many times we look at the seventh day as a day God takes away from us. But the word says very clearly that the Sabbath was made for man. You see? It's a gift from God to us. And on the outside looking in, it looks like God's taken a day away from me each week. But from the inside looking out, you realize that the Sabbath is a palace where the Lord of the Sabbath dwells. And only from the inside can you really know the wonder and the beauty of entering into that palace. From the outside, the Sabbath just looks like nothing. But from the inside, it has the fragrance of the Garden of Eden to it. Because the first time Sabbath is mentioned is back in Genesis chapter 2, where God finishes the 6 days of creation and says, and he Shabbatted. He rested on that seventh day. Sabbath is not mentioned again until here, when God gives manna. Because you see, by him giving manna, just raining bread from heaven, was kind of like the garden where everything just grew up. It's paradise. It's all right there. Eat. You can eat of all the trees of the garden. No, there's except that one. You can eat of all the trees of the garden. Just eat. It's there. It's free. There's no striving, no stress. You're in my presence. We walk together. We converse together. We fellowship together. And so the next time Shabbat is mentioned is when he gives manna and he's calling his people back and saying, here's a fragrance of the garden. It's a fragrance of the world to come. In other words, one day a week, if we enter into it, it's there. It's available. If we enter into it, we get a taste of the world to come, the eternal Sabbath that's just up around the corner. It's made for man. How can we honor God? By taking this amazing gift he's given us, then looking at it says, don't look like much, and then thumb your nose at it. And you can't say, well, I use the Sabbath to do this and that activity and do this and this. You know, if you're doing that, it's not a Sabbath anymore. It's not a Sabbath anymore. So, I just want to encourage you and challenge you. Enter into the Sabbath. And it's something you cannot understand from the outside. You can only experience and grow to appreciate and enjoy and feed upon this holy nourishment God gives us that comes through the Sabbath. Now, I got to tell you something. When you start doing it, it's going to drive you a bit nuts for a few weeks. It's going to drive you a bit nuts because it's like somebody trying to withdraw from caffeine. You know, just, I got to work. I'm wired to work. You know, and honestly, you're just kind of vibrating with, you know, wanting to reach for the remote control, wanting to go shopping, wanting to go mow the, well, not mow the grass. That's never been one of my hangups. But you just want to, but it, honestly, there's a withdrawal. There's a withdrawal from the addiction to work, the addiction to doing what I want to do on the Sabbath, and learn to keep it holy, to guard it, to rest on it. And when finally you get over the delirium tremors, oh, is it ever wonderful? Is it ever wonderful? It's an incredible gift from God. I got this quote from Rabbi Schneerson. which I think is wonderful. It says, the Sabbath and the manna share a common purpose, to underscore our complete dependency upon God as the true source of all sustenance. Our work is no more than a vessel through which God's blessings can flow. Here's one of the things the Sabbath has done for me. There's an awareness I guess I had in my head, but it never really sunk down in my very heart and being. But I think a lot of us are like this. We think, okay, I've got a body here, and I still have some years ahead of me, and I have my health. I got a career, and I got a place to live, and I got this and this and this. You know what? But there's something missing in my life. I know what it is. It's God. So I'm going to add God to my life, and everything's good. I'm complete now. And that's how we all kind of start out. And finally, we get God thrown in, and now it's like, all right, all the empty spots are full now. I've got it. I've got everything. But God takes us through this process to where we begin to realize, I don't have God. God has me. And it's not that I've added God to my way of doing things, but I've become his slave. I was a slave to Pharaoh. I had to do what I was told. But now I choose to do what I'm told by him, because I find every decree and statute and commandment, everything he speaks to me, is wonderful. And like David would say, I love your instructions. They're life to me. I love your Torah. And I want to know it. I want to do it because it's my delight. And you begin to realize that your career, your health, your future, your finances, all those things, they're not yours. They're tools that your boss, your master, has given you in order to fulfill his will. You see? So instead of adding God to your pile of stuff, you realize it's not your stuff to start with. In fact, you are not your own. You're bought with a price. And then you realize, I belong to him. Oh, and look, he's given me a body. He's given me some talents. He's given me a career. He's given me a family. He's given me these things, and I'm to use every one of those to obey his will, to obey his commandments. And what a delight that is. We were created for good works in Christ Jesus, the word tells us. That's what you're created for. You see? And God has given you the Sabbath, a day of rest. He's a very kind master. Let us not thumb our nose at this precious gift he's given us. It's a life-changing thing he's given us. I see Dale's hand up. I want to go on to one more quote, and then we'll take your comment, Dale. Deuteronomy 8:3. Now, we all know how Yeshua quoted Deuteronomy 8. He said, man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God, right? Well, let's look at the whole verse. And he humbled you and let you hunger and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of Adonai. See, this passage here about living by the words that come from Adonai's mouth is attached to the manna. And when he gave the manna, he gave the commandment to rest. He gave the commandment on the seventh day, protect it, guard it, keep it holy, rest on it. Don't do your work. In fact, you don't even have to go out and collect manna on that day if you did the work the day before. You see, by keeping the Sabbath, what you're doing, you are witnessing to the world around you that my security is not in my job. My security is not in my paycheck. My security is in him. You guys, you schlubs, may all have to go out there and work on the Shabbat. But I'm going to rest. Now, with that said, I'm not calling you a schlub if you do it, provide a life-saving service on the Shabbat. Physicians and people who repair electrical systems, we have an elder who often has to work on Shabbat. He's out there keeping our electricity going, which is a life-saving thing. There are some jobs which have to be done on the Shabbat because they are for life. They bring life. What you have to do is decide, is this something that's bringing life, or is it just for my own entertainment? Is this truly giving life to others, or just increasing my overtime? And that's a decision I don't make for you. And I don't judge you. I don't know what you do on Shabbat. That's up to you. So please don't hear anything condemning here. Please don't do that. And when I know someone is working on Shabbat, I don't condemn them. I'm just trusting it's between them and God. And I think the best of them. That's what I do. All right? I just choose to do that. I do not condemn anyone. And I don't want you doing that either. All right? We're not the Shabbat police. We're not the Shabbat police. So the Shabbat is meant to give life, and if we enter into it, we will receive a double portion, an abundance of life in ourselves, spiritual life, that seriously is a foretaste of the world to come. It's a level of life that's absolutely incredible and amazing. And it keeps getting better and better and better. Okay, Dale. Yes, sir. Yes.
And the past is so important, and sometimes we have to go back and relive these little episodes of our past and look and see there's God in the banner right above that and saying, look what those decisions you made and what you went through.
Yes.
And now I've got you.
Mm-hmm.
I've got your attention.
That's right. That's right. Well put. Well put. Oh, I'm tempted to keep talking about this subject. We've got to move on. We have other things to do. Yes, Rob.
We've been talking this morning, it seems like the common theme is that our strength, our source, our strength comes from God. Mm-hmm. And the nourishment is from the heavens, not necessarily
the
service.
Yes.
I read something last night that's kind of a paradigm shift for me. It was that the tree of life, the garden,
mm-hmm.
the rabbis, the Hebrews have a different concept of that, that the tree is upside down.
Oh. Yes, right. Yeah, we'll put Rob, for those who are might be listening on the recording, Rob is just sharing that one of the ancient legends of the rabbis is that the tree of life in the garden, its roots were not down the earth, its roots were in heaven. And that's a wonderful way to think of it. Because, and truly, its source was the spiritual realm. Yeah, very well, very good. Well, then we come to water again, this time water from a rock. And we find this passage in chapter 17. We'll start with verse 1. The entire assembly of the children of Israel journeyed from the wilderness of Sin, and this is where we get the word Sinai, to their journeys. According to the word of Adonai, they encamped in Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink, no water at all. Not even bitter water to throw a tree in. The people contended with Moses, and they said, give us water that we may drink. Moses said to them, why do you contend with me? Why do you test Adonai? The people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses, and it said, why is this that you have brought us up from Egypt to kill me and my children and my livestock through thirst? People just don't learn, do they? Much like us. Moses cried out to Adonai, saying, what shall I do for this people? A bit more, and they will stone me. And God says, that gives me an idea. They're going to use a stone to kill Moses. So God uses a stone to bring forth water. Adonai said to Moses, pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and in your hand, now this is interesting, in your hand take your staff with which you turned the dust into lice? No. Take your staff which turned into a serpent? No. Take in your hand the staff that parted the Red Sea? Uh-uh. See, it's very important to catch these details. Take in your staff with which you struck the river. Remember, he struck the river, and what was the result? Blood. The first time Moses struck something with the staff, the result was blood. The next time he strikes something to the staff, the result is water. Who was struck and out came blood and water? There's a wonderful picture here. Striking the river and turned to blood was a terrible plague. It was awful. It was ugly. It was deadly. It stunk. It was just a terrible, terrible, terrible thing. Striking the rock and bringing forth water was a wonderful thing. One was death, the other life. And when you look at the execution, the crucifixion of Yeshua, you can see both of these things. It was horrendous and ugly, and it was all death. There was nothing good about it. On the other hand, that was my sin being crucified there. And through that body and blood, I am alive and free. And what was death here was life as well. The death was in Egypt. Striking the rock was over here at Sinai. You see, the two locations, one is in the world. But this is, we're getting closer to the spiritual realm, the place where God's going to speak audibly to everyone. Now, what's interesting here is there's no commandment attached to this. But there's an important insight, and I think we can almost take it as a commandment. Look at verse 7. He called the place Massa Meribah because of the contention of the children of Israel. Massa and Meribah mean like complaint and contention. Because of their test of Adonai saying, is Adonai among us or not? This is what we tend to do. And over through Scripture, it refers back to Massa and Meribah. Always the people testing God at Massa and Meribah. They tested him other times, but this is the one that's like the focal point, because this is the one where we tend to test God. We don't cease to believe that he exists. We don't stop believing that he's all-powerful. We don't even stop believing that he's gracious and good and loving. We just start doubting he's with me. Is God in my midst or not? Is he here? He used to be. Is he now? I don't think he is. That is a thing, is an insult to God. He's told us, I'm with you. I won't leave you or forsake you. I've always proven that even though you couldn't see me, I was there. I was working these miracles, bringing forth food, bringing forth drink, keeping you alive in miraculous ways. Why now do you reach another tough spot? Why can't you pass the test? Why can't you learn from your past failures how to pass the test? You know, I can guarantee you, as a school teacher, if I give people a kid a test and he fails it, and then I go over it and correct it with him and show him the right answers, if I give him that same test again, he'll do pretty good on it. But it seems like with God, we keep failing even when we've been given the answers. I've given you the cheat sheet. You know what the answer is here. I am with you. Oh, is he? I don't think he's with me. Robin and I were talking about this. You know, we want certainty. God does not give us certainty. He gives us faith. Faith is not certainty. I know it's the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. But our experience of faith is not that. When we choose to exercise faith, when we choose to exercise it, then it's as good as certainty. It's as good as substance of things hoped for. It's as good as evidence of things not seen. But if we don't exercise it, there's no certainty at all. We must choose to believe God does not lie to us. But here's what happens. They say, is Adonai among us or not? Amalek came and battled Israel at Rephidim. Boom! All of a sudden they're under attack. No warning. And though I've used this overhead before, I know it will run us over time a little bit, I guarantee you this will be worth it. When we're talking about spiritual things, we need God to explain things to us because we're very spiritual, deaf and blind. Spiritual warfare on two fronts. Who are the two enemies we've encountered now in our story? Egypt and now Amalek. Egypt and Amalek. When it came to Egypt, who did the fighting? God did all the fighting. He told the people, you stand still. Okay? You stand still. And he goes behind them, and he holds off Egypt until the Israelites get across the sea. Then he allows the cavalry to come in, and he closes up the waters and drowns them all. They saw the bodies washing up on the shore. God did all the battle. They did not have to lift one finger to fight. With Amalek, they did all the fighting. Amalek means people of licking up. That's what it means. People of licking up. Everything about Egypt and Pharaoh is a picture of Satan. And God does the fighting against him. Amalek is a picture of the flesh. Because you see, we have flesh made out of the dust. And our flesh, not only will it return to the dust, it wants to right now. It wants to do like Satan, who is condemned. The serpent was condemned to feed upon the dust, right? When he was cursed. And there's something in us, we want to go to our physical appetites, to our animal appetites, and feed on the things of the dirt, of the earth. Whatever those appetites are. That God has placed in us another appetite through our spirit where we're hungry for him as well. And we want to walk in the spirit, but boy, we love walking in the flesh too. We can't do both. Like a seesaw, walk in the flesh or walk in the spirit. One goes up, one goes down. And he says, if you walk in the spirit, you will not fulfill the lusts of the flesh. But this battle against Amalek is something we are constantly doing. Satan may have been a past master. We have little to do with him now. They never went back to Egypt. Amalek is a would-be master, and it constantly attacks us. Satan's already defeated. In fact, in John, it says First John says he cannot even touch you. And I get pretty fed up with people who always talk about the power of Satan. Listen, folks, he has no power. He's just a liar. And if you believe it, then you give him power, because it's your power he's using. He has none of his own. Amalek is an ongoing warfare. Satan's an enemy behind Moses. He comes from behind, but God's dealt with him. He's back there. We don't have to look back. But Amalek is right in front of us, and we're constantly fighting it. Israel had no relationship, genealogical relationship with Egypt. But Amalek was cousins. There was a physical relationship there. They were children of what? Ishmael or Esau? Esau, I believe. Satan desires our total destruction, but Amalek wants to exploit our weaknesses. When it came to Egypt, God said, stand. And when you read in Galatians about putting on the whole armor of God, it says that when it comes to the enemy, we do what? We attack? We stand. We just stand. He wants our ground. All we have to do is stand it. Right? But when it comes to Amalek, we're commanded, fight. Egypt, though, continued to be an internal enemy. Though Pharaoh is dealt with, they never see Egypt again. There's always this thing inside of them says, oh, I want to go back. Oh, I want to go back to the leeks, garlic, and onions of Egypt, the flesh pots of Egypt, where we sat, we ate bread to satiety, we were just full. Oh, it was happy days. So though they were out of Egypt, Egypt wasn't out of them yet. And when it comes to Satan, still a battle just for the mind. He still speaks lies. And Egypt and Pharaoh were still lying to the people, even though they've been dealt with. But the lies were there, and they had to battle them with truth. But Amalek is an external enemy. It's fleshly. I mean, we're attached to it. It's always attacking us if we fail to walk in the Spirit. So Egypt was a continuing battle in the mind, but Amalek's a continuing battle in the flesh. I want you to look at something that's just absolutely amazing. Some of the most stunning passages of Scripture there is. Look at down to verse 14. Verse 14, Adonai said to Moses, this is after the battle is over, write this as a remembrance in the book and recite it in the ears of Joshua. Now you ready? I shall surely erase the memory of Amalek from under the heavens. Got it? What's God going to do? Erase, not just Amalek, erase its memory from under the heavens. Okay, good, good. No more problem with Amalek, right? But then you go on. Verse 15, Moses built an altar and called its name, Adonai is my miracle, Adonai Nisi. And he said, for a hand is on the throne of God. Adonai maintains a war against Amalek from generation to generation. And you could add to generation to generation to generation to generation to generation. Well, wait a minute. It says, I'll erase the memory of Amalek from under the heavens. Yet you fight him generation after generation after generation. Well, which is it? It's an amazing passage. We could say the same thing about the battles of the flesh. God someday is going to erase this battle of the flesh, erase the memory of it from under heaven, because we'll have new bodies. But until then, generation after generation after generation, Amalek attacks. And it's ready to defend. Well, how did they defeat Amalek? You know, Satan uses falsehood, lie. Serpent's only got a mouth, the only thing he can use to attack. But Amalek uses treachery. Defense against Satan is truth, but defense against Amalek is obedience. Let's look at how they defeated Amalek, and then we'll close. If you back up a bit, verse 8, Amalek came and battled Israel at Rephidim. Moses said to Joshua, this is the first time Joshua's name is mentioned in the Bible. The first time he's mentioned. This is kind of cool because Joshua and Yeshua are the same name. Joshua and Yeshua are the same name. Now, we've seen pictures of Yeshua in Joseph's life, in the Passover lamb, and all kinds of things. But now we see Yeshua's name actually mentioned. Everything about Joshua in the Torah and in the book of Joshua and throughout the Old Testament, it's a picture of Yeshua. So Moses said to Joshua, "Choose people for us and go to battle with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." So who's the key to winning? Joshua or Moses? Yes, both. All right? Joshua did as Moses said to him. And Yeshua did as Moses commanded. To do battle with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur ascended to the top of the hill. It happened that when Moses raised his hand with the staff in it, Israel was stronger. And when he lowered his hand, Amalek was stronger. Moses' hands grew heavy. So they took a stone, put it under him, he sat on it. Aaron and Hur, the gun on both sides, supported his hands, one on this side, one on that side, and he remained with his hands faithful until sunset. That's what the word is, faithful. And then it says, Joshua weakened Amalek and his people the sword's blade. In other words, when the staff of Moses is raised, Joshua, Yeshua in our lives is strong. It's a powerful truth. But when we start getting weak, we start letting the Torah slip. Oh, so tired of keeping the Torah. Yeshua gets weak in our lives. Amalek begins to win. The best thing you can do to keep the power of Yeshua strong in your life is to strengthen the hands of Moses in your life, because the Torah and Yeshua are not at odds. He says, "Don't even think I came to abolish the Torah. I came to show you how it's done." That's what he said. We want Yeshua to be strong in our lives and keep Torah strong in our lives. And that leads us on then to the end of our endless teaching. Okay. There's one more food source. Torah. I want you to go over to chapter 24 of Exodus. We're going to skip ahead a little bit because there's one more meal. There's one more source of food. In chapter 20, God gives us 10 commandments. In the following few chapters, he gives more of his Torah, his commandments, decrees, and statutes. Israel says, everything God has said, we'll do. We will hear it and we will do it. And then in chapter 24, verse 9, God invites them up on Mount Sinai. And it says, Moses, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, 70 of the elders of Israel ascended. They saw the God of Israel. And under his feet was the likeness of sapphire brickwork. And it was like the essence of the heaven in purity. Against the great men of the children of Israel, he did not stretch out his hand. They gazed at God, yet they ate and drank. Where did this food come from? This is absolutely, purely, completely spiritual food. You know, you say, well, the manna was too. Yeah, it was, but there's still some physical input. You had to gather it, and then you could cook it or bake it or fry it or, you know, whatever you wanted to do with it before you ate it. But when they finally received the Torah, they ascend to the mountain, and now they see this God who they doubted was even in their midst earlier. And they ate and drank. God supplied all the food. It's utterly spiritual. They didn't have to lift one finger to prepare that meal. There was no physical input whatsoever. Do you see that as we proceed with God, our food becomes less earthly and more spiritual? Our sustenance is less of this world and more of that one. And it becomes less and less and less I have God and more and more and more he's got me. And it's not that I want God to do my bidding. All I want is to do his. There's one other little thing it's easy to miss. Leaven and matzah. The matzah and the manna. Remember matzah, the only reason it was unleavened is because they didn't have what? Time to let it rise. And yet the manna, the bread that God rains from heaven, is attached to time. The matzah was unleavened because they did not have time, but when God gives manna, he attaches it to taking one day out of seven and devoting it completely to him and saying, I want you to take time now and invest it in resting in my kingdom, experiencing the world to come, acknowledging that I'm the source of your security, of your income, and everything else. And I want you to rest as children of the king. I want you to return for one day a week to the garden. God created the world in 6 days, including Adam and Eve on the sixth day. He rested. Then after that rest, Adam and Eve went to work. It begins with a rest. And now that rest, we can be productive. And so when the manna comes, it's attached to time. But you know what? When you go to Mount Sinai and you sit and you gaze upon God, you're gazing upon the timeless. And this is too wonderful for me even to think about, much less teach about. But there's something about as we grow closer to God, as his word becomes more full in our lives, his commandments begin to influence, we feed upon them, they affect everything we do and even the way we think, that we're feeding upon food that is beyond this world. And this is true spiritual nourishment. True spiritual nourishment. It becomes less and less physical and more spiritual, the true food of God. And then I think of Yeshua in Revelation 3:20. He says, behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in unto him, and I will what? I will eat with him, and he with me. You've seen those pictures where Jesus stands at the door knocking door. There's no doorknob on the outside. There's one thing left out of that picture. That's the picnic basket in his other hand. You know? And God's got nourishment for us that is beyond this world, literally. But we must invest time to partake of that. We must be committed to living it out. And I tell you what, that's when life really starts to rock. It really starts to rock. All right, well, let's close in prayer. We've gone over plenty. Father, thank you so much for this wonderful passage of Scripture. Lord, there's so much packed in here that we never get done feeding upon it. Lord, there's always more nourishment where that came from. You're so faithful. Your manna is available to us each morning. And your manna, the daily supply, gives us all we need for the day. But the next morning, we must go out and gather again. So, Father, help us to be faithful to feed daily upon your precious word. To feed upon it, to chew it, and make it a part of ourselves. And let us not rely today upon yesterday's supply. It was good for yesterday, but not for today. So help us to be faithful to every day. Come to you and receive what you have for us from your word. Lord, I pray you give us a heart that hungers and thirsts after righteousness, and that we would enter into your Shabbat and discover how Yeshua is Lord of that day, and we would experience his lordship on that day like we never have on the other six. Lord, you've given us a wonderful gift that looks like nothing in the eyes of the world. Oh, but it is everything in your world. Because all of the world to come is Shabbat. Thank you for that, Father. Open our eyes to the wonder of what you've done. We'll give you the praise and the glory for it. In the precious name of our Redeemer, our Savior, our Master, our Lord, the lover of our soul, our best friend, Yeshua. Amen.